Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
And this is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We've been following along the Gospel according to St. Luke, and come today to that part in the first chapter of Luke where Mary sets out as quickly as she could to a town in the hill country of Judea, and sometimes called Al-Karim. And there she went to Zechariah's house, and she greeted Elizabeth. So we know the story. We know the background of all this. We know that this is after the Annunciation, and so that Mary herself now is with child. We know the story of how Elizabeth came to be able to carry a child in her own age, and the whole drama of Zechariah in the temple when he reportedly won't take seriously the idea that he and his elderly wife were going to bring forth a child. He's struck dumb in the temple because of that. And then throughout the pregnancy of Elizabeth, he is unable to speak. It's during this high drama, we have no idea how the communication was made, how from near Jerusalem the word reached Nazareth, that Mary herself was with child, or that Elizabeth was with child. It says that the angel Gabriel told Mary that even now her cousin, who was beyond childbearing age, is to be with child, so that she might know that all things are possible with God. So Mary sets out as a lady, a young woman herself expecting a child, for the long and arduous journey from Nazareth to near Jerusalem. It's kind of interesting because even to drive it today is a bit of a trip, and it must have been a several days' journey on foot. But Mary arrives at the home of Zechariah and greets Elizabeth. And it says in the Gospel now, as soon as Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the child leapt in her womb. And Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit, and she gave a loud cry and said, "Of all women you are the most blessed, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. Why should I be honored with a visit from the mother of my Lord? For the moment your greeting reached my ears, the child in my womb leapt for joy. Yes, blessed is she who believed that the promise made her by the Lord would be fulfilled." There's not only a very touching human story in all of this, of the younger woman and the older woman, both with child, realizing in both cases that it happened by the hand of God, and it was something out of the course of nature and out of the course of time. And so they know that both of them are involved in a tremendous drama, and they have some inkling as to what that drama is all about. Mary, of course, says, you know, how can this be? And the angel says to her, the Holy Spirit will come upon you, and you will have a child, and the child shall be called the Son of God. And Elizabeth, of course, is taken by total surprise and knows that when her husband comes home from his time in the sanctuary, that he is unable to speak, and then, miracle of miracles, long past her menopause, she carries a child. So that now there is this not only a human drama going on, but there is a divine drama going on. And Luke, as the situates this deep in the story of the Old Testament, and there is certainly in Elizabeth's talk, there is a reference and an echo of the words of David to the Ark of the Lord, which when it came and remained in the house of Obed-Edom for 3 months in 2 Samuel 6:9-11, And so there is now an acknowledgement in the language of the gospel that what is happening now, that Elizabeth is paraphrasing David in front of the ark. Elizabeth recognizes now that the new ark of the covenant, the new God-bearer, the new Theotokos, has entered into her presence. Not only does she know this, but also the child in her womb leaps for joy. Now, it's not unusual, certainly, for someone in their 6 month to feel the movement of their child, but this is something that is specifically designated to show recognition. And it borrows the language again of the Old Testament. From Genesis 25, it borrows the idea of the movement in the womb is the indication of that which is to come forth into the world. The notion that, for instance, when Rachel, I believe, is pregnant with Jacob and Esau, she feels them struggling inside the womb, and she knows that there will be conflict between the two of them when they're born. And that she understands and knows that the great drama of the founding of a people is going on already inside of her. And so this then we have to deepen this, we have to expand this, and so it's not just two expectant mothers meeting each other. It is not only a human story, not only, as I said, it's not only a story of affection and care, but it's also a story of a divine drama. So what is the divine drama that's going on? Elizabeth echoes the words of David to the Ark of the Covenant. So it's very clear that what we find in this story of what we call the Visitation, it's very clear that what we find is that the Ark of the Old Covenant, the last of the prophecies, encounters the Ark of the New Covenant, the coming of the Lord. And it is intentional within the Gospels that this reality be reflected as the proper way of the encounter between the Old Covenant and the New, between that which has been and the fulfillment of the promise that it was made. The idea being that in the transfer of election from the Old Covenant to the New Covenant, from the Old Covenant to the days and the disciples of Jesus, this is supposed to be joyful and peaceful. Mary is the bearer of the Christ, Elizabeth of John the Baptist. And there's a lot of perplexity, and I don't know that anybody really understands this relationship now between John the Baptist and Jesus Christ. But one thing that we find is the Gospels carry this out in a very interesting way. There is no indication that John and Jesus ever met again, except when they were both in their mother's wombs. It doesn't mean that they didn't, but it means that we have no record that they did. We have the famous paintings of the mothers with their children, but that's from apocryphal literature, from Gnostic literature, and we're not really sure. There's no reason to speculate they didn't come together, perhaps maybe even at the High Holy Days in Jerusalem. But we don't know that, and the gospel doesn't reveal that to us. So that the great encounter is not the meeting of the children and in Jerusalem at the High Holy Days. The great encounter is when they are contained within the ark of that covenant, which contains them, holds them, and carries them through the ages. As the story of John the Baptist goes on, the next time we really encounter him, he has already passed through the desert, he has already gone through whatever the desert experience was for him, and he has come to the Jordan, and he is preaching metanoia, change of heart, the forgiveness of sins. And he then points out the Lamb of God, referring, of course, to the idea of the suffering servant of the prophecies of Isaiah. The lamb is the paschal lamb, the sacrificial lamb, the one that was to be offered and consumed in the deliverance from Egypt in the Passover of the Lord. John identifies Jesus as now the paschal lamb, the one who will be sacrificed for the sake of his people, for the deliverance of his people. And he's honest about that. And he, as the old covenant, acknowledges and recognizes the presence of the living God in the new covenant. This is a gospel theme. Then, the next time we really encounter John, he is in prison. And he's troubled and he's worried because what happens is that he has acknowledged Jesus as the Lamb. He has acknowledged him as the one who is to deliver Israel. But now what he finds is this is not occurring, that somehow or other there is not a great triumph of the new covenant, that somehow it shows very much that no matter how illuminated John the Baptist was, he was a child of the old covenant. And when the new one appears, he's troubled by it in some sense. He doesn't see it being as what maybe he thought it would be. And so from prison, he sends messengers to Jesus and say, "Are you the one who is to come, or should we wait for another?" And Jesus sends back and does not say, "No, it's all right, here I am." He sends back and he says, "Go back and tell him this." And then again, he quotes the prophecies of Isaiah. So that the old covenant then, in the original joy of the encounter with the living God in the new covenant, the old covenant then begins to wonder, begins to question, is this really what it seemed to be? Is this really the fulfillment of expectation? And the new covenant looks back to the old covenant and says, "Hear your own prophecies. Hear the words that have sent you forth. Hear the words, John, which you yourself have proclaimed." And he quotes to him the prophecies of Isaiah. It's after that, then, that John, having been reassured by the prophecies of Isaiah, offers up his life for the sake, interestingly enough, he is in prison for his position on the illegality and the incestuousness of the marriage of Herodias and Herod. So it is an interesting thing and something we should keep in the back of our minds. Marriage, since this is all about covenant, marriage, therefore, is the covenant within the human family which most closely represents the covenant between God and his people. When that is distorted, when that is broken, then there is an inability in many ways to believe. The scriptures feel very strongly there's an inability to believe in the trustworthiness and the fidelity of God. So it's interesting that John dies for a marriage issue, but a marriage issue in the sense of the legality and the orderliness of the covenant on earth, which reflects the covenant between God and his people. This is why this is such an important thing, and this is why there seems to be kind of a darkness clouding the heart and the mind of many of the Reformation country hierarchy who fail really to grasp the biblical proportions of this whole discussion and this whole nature and the whole nature of marriage itself. This is not something that's surprising, and it's not something that certainly we know to be a struggle in the modern world. The idea of stability, the idea of faithfulness, lifelong, all of this kind of thing, we struggle with that in a very mobile world, in a world which is, I suppose, Francis is kind of a throwaway world in which nothing lasts forever and nothing is enduring. It reflects itself, the threat to the marriage covenant, reflects itself in everything that we do. It's interesting, you know, we used to even build religious buildings with the idea they would last for hundreds and hundreds of years. Then we found them, as the population shift, abandoned. And we found them empty, and we found all sorts of things that were culturally shocking to a faith anchored in the eternal stability of the relationship between God and his people. And so we start to build more throwaway things now, more temporary things, and that affects That affects our sense of the permanency of the faith and the permanency of God's relationship with us. And that reflects itself in our behavior and in our values and in our understanding of things. So, yeah, it is a very tumultuous time for us and a very, very difficult time for the faith. I think that many people struggle with the nature of the church. And as the church's wounds and as her weaknesses are continually exposed to us, there is a sense, you know, well, how transcendent is all of this? How permanent is all of this? Aren't we on pretty shaky ground with all of this? So we face a particular challenge in the 20th and the 21st centuries. We face the challenge of the failure of human nature in the 20th century to preserve even a decently humane society. We find this, then we find, because of that failure, an age riddled with bizarre ideologies that bring instability, fear, and make-believe, illusion, into the realities of our everyday life. This is not something that we deal easily with, which is why it's very important when we go back then to the Gospels, when we go back to the Scriptures, we find that what we're doing is we are engaging in a phenomenon and in a reality that has existed for us for thousands of years. And certainly the Ark of the Covenant, Mary, the Mother of the Lord, the Theotokos, the God-bearer, that Mary herself then becomes one of the foci of stability and of permanency in the faith life of the people, which is why Mary has played such a dramatic and important role in the modern story of our faith. And perhaps it explains the multiplicity of apparitions and elocutions and so forth that gives us Lourdes and Fatima and many others, perhaps less stable than that. But the idea that somehow or other Mary, the Ark of the Covenant, re-enters into human history, carrying within her the Son, the Lord, bearing God into the world, is not something that should surprise us or something that seems, you know, out of place for us. And so we are being reassured by this very story, by this very story of the visitation of Mary and Elizabeth. It also has to do with the relationship between the new and the old covenant. Human sinfulness over the years has created a deep division between the people of the old covenant and the people of the new. And that this deep division is a division caused by human sinfulness. It began very early. You know, in the Roman Empire, the Jews had a situation which was called for them the isopoliteia. They were an isolated and unique people within the Roman Empire, the only ones excused from emperor worship, and therefore protected in their faith, in their religion, by the law. When in fact, in the conflicts within the synagogues between those who followed Jesus and those who did not, the Christians were expelled from the synagogue. It wasn't that we just don't agree with you anymore. It exposed them to the Roman Empire and exposed them to the laws of the Roman Empire. They were no longer exempt from emperor worship, and they were therefore vulnerable to oppression, to force, and to persecution. And despite the scholarly make-believe of Candida Moss at Notre Dame, there was a persecution, and a virulent persecution from time to time within the Roman Empire. It might not have been as absolute, because if the Roman Empire really wanted to exterminate Christianity and had a mindset to do that, and this is probably where Moss is drawing her theory from, they probably could have, but it was sporadic. But it was no less bloody and no less frightening because it was sporadic than if it had been an all-out assault on the Christian people. And certainly if the persecution had not been going on, the great, first of all of the apostles were martyred except John. That's kind of a beginning to say, you know, what was this theory you had? And also the whole story of the handing over of the books, the forgiveness of the sins of apostasy, all of those kinds of things are part of the patchwork of the relationship between early Christianity and the Roman Empire. So there was therefore enmity between the people of the Old Covenant and the people of the New, right from the very beginning, from the days of the apostles themselves, when the expulsion from the synagogues began. There's all sorts of supposedly scholarly works and so forth. James Carroll's book, Constantine's Sword, is another kind of make-believe. It's kind of like, let's blame Christianity for all of the experiences of anti-Semitism in the world. All you have to do, really, is go back and study the relationship between the Roman governors and the Jewish people to know that this was not a creation of Christianity itself. It came from an early conflict, certainly it did. But to say that, therefore, Catholicism is responsible for all the anti-Semitism in the world, and to proclaim in some modern university courses and so forth that Catholicism is at the root of the Holocaust is fantasy and ideology. It is not the truth. It's much more complicated than that. And much, much more complicated than that. There is a young Polish priest, and his first name is Pavel. I can't remember the last name. But he works very hard. I think he's the spokesman for the Polish Bishops' Conference. But he also does a great deal of scholarly research on the relationship between Christians and Jews during the Nazi occupation of Poland. And it comes out a very, very different picture from that image of kind of absolute division and absolute conflict. That absolute division, absolute conflict, was something that Rudolf Hochhuth in the Stellvertreter, in the play The Deputy, financed, pretty much so they know now, by the Russian KGB and the Soviet Union, to absolutely blacken the name of Pius XII and make it very clear that the Catholic Church was complicit in the Holocaust. That is not true, because even the archives show that not to be the case. And I personally have the privilege of knowing a Jewish person whose family was delivered from the Holocaust by the Vatican and reunited in the States. So it's always complicated. Whenever they come out with these absolutes, we have to be very careful, because they really usually are not universally applicable. Was there conflict between Jews and Christians? Yes. Was there unfairness between Jews and Christians? Yes. Was there persecution of Jews by Christians? Yes. Was Christianity responsible for all anti-Semitism, for the Holocaust? No. And was Catholicism never bought into the rabid anti-Semitism, for instance, of Luther and the Reformation? So it's a very checkered story. One, however, which never conforms to the harmony that is reflected in the Gospel according to St. Luke, when the Old and the New Covenant encounter each other in the meeting between Elizabeth and Mary. As we then enter into a time when the Gospels are going to begin to give forth the notion and the idea of the coming of the Son of God, of the God-man, into the world, which is what we celebrate in the Old. In the early church, the great celebration of the Incarnation, interestingly enough, was the Annunciation, was the 25th of March, that it was at the moment of his conception, interestingly enough, that Jesus was proclaimed the Son of God. It has something, perhaps, to do with the whole beginning of life argument, and helps it to become more and more unconscionable that someone who professes to believe in Jesus Christ does not acknowledge a human life exists at the moment of conception, when in fact, for two or three centuries, in fact, is up until the 400s, that was the feast of the Incarnation of the Lord, was the Incarnation, was the feast of the Annunciation. So When we therefore then move into this great revelation is to take place, when the Ark of the Covenant is to fully become one
with the human race, whether it is the Annunciation or whether it is the Nativity of the Lord in December, it is the same celebration. It is a celebration that now Emmanuel, God among us, that God has come among us and dwells among us. And as such, now, the beginning of the total opening of the reality of God's love for his people, of his care for his people, is born as a seed in history. And it's interesting, I think, also, that Jesus, that the Jews, first of all, were Middle Easterners, and that Jesus is born a Middle Easterner. It is kind of a place where it is just simply kind of a combination of all the aspects of humanity, and that it therefore is not able to be racially distinguished. When someone says, you know, that Christians, and I know art has not really helped us in this understanding, but Jesus was not Nordic, and Jesus was not radically Caucasian. Jesus was a man of the Middle East, and shared with the man from his mother the ethnic realities of Middle Easterners, It isn't surprising that God chose such a place, but sometimes we fail to reflect adequately upon just how interesting that is, that he's not Nordic, he's not African, he's not really Asian. He is none of those definitive, very definitive groups, and that he kind of steps in between them all. He kind of comes from among them all without being them themselves. And that so when he bursts forth into the world, and when he comes forth into the world to fulfill the covenant, he comes into a world racked with sinfulness, which is why John the Baptist says in the beginning, repent, and why Jesus says in the beginning, for only when our hearts are turned toward him, only when our hearts are open to him, then there is, in fact, the beginning of the fulfillment of the covenant. Meanwhile, the human experience of fidelity and covenant and so forth moves with us so that we have the capacity. Our experience creates for us the capacity to understand and to believe the revelation of God. It is a gift of faith, but human experience is kind of theology 101. It's where we draw our images from and draw our concepts from in order to understand this mysterious reality that God has come to dwell among us, that God is one of us, and that God is within. It's all a great drama and a great story. And while, you know, Christmas has been overly commercialized, at the same time, the feast remains. And from the simplicity of the birth of the Lord opens up the complexity of the salvation of humanity, the redemption of humanity. And maybe during this season in our prayer, we might want to follow that, and we might want to look upon that and to see that, yes, here it is. Here is, in fact, the coming of the fulfillment of the covenant.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.
Veni Sancti.